Welcome to another special flash edition of Musinomics, supported by Luminate. In New York, I'm Larry Miller from the Music Business Program at NYU Steinhardt.
And also in New York, I am Lynn Gonzalez. I'm happy to be here again. I'm a partner at the entertainment law firm Granderson Des Rochers, and I am a proud graduate of the NYU Steinhardt School in the Music Business Program.
Welcome back to Musinomics, Lynn. Glad to have you.
Thanks for having me again. I'm happy to be here.
We'll be discussing the IFPI 2023 Global Music Report, Spotify's fourth edition of Loud and Clear, their annual State of the State on what's happening inside their business where data is concerned. We're going to talk about a really interesting story that popped up in the AI front this week, a little bit about BandLab and more.
That sounds great. I'm ready to dive in, Larry.
Our lead story this week is the IFPI 2023 Global Music Report. The organization measures global music revenues, among other things. The Global Music Report for 2023 says that revenues were up 10.2% to $28.6 billion, with a B. On-demand subscription streaming was up over 11% to $14 billion for almost half of all recorded music revenues. And first-time-ever price increases at Spotify helped, along with price increases from Apple Music and Amazon and others. Total streaming revenues, including advertising revs, were up 10.4% to $19.3 billion, a little over two-thirds of the total market. Lynn, your take.
You know, when I focused on this story, the things that really jumped out at me were the developing territories, in particular what was happening in Africa juxtaposed with what's happening in China. I saw another story on an African streaming service, Dundo, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right, talking about how they've just hit 30 million in active monthly users at the end of 2023, and they have a goal of getting to 50 million by the end of 2025. You know, this service had zero paid users in 2020, but adoption has grown since partnering with the telecoms. I just find that really interesting when you think about how China's market has developed, and in particular with Tencent. Tencent recently revealed that their subscription revenue soared 45% in China, attributed to growth in the subscriber base, and 20% year-over-year increase based on subscription fees. Overall, it seems like Tencent has taken the approach of increasing offerings across its services for a more compelling user experience, and it's paying off. Separately, they face some revenue loss due to crackdowns on like social entertainment services, maybe gambling. But its music gains were enough to mitigate the loss from the social entertainment sector. When I see the trajectory of growth happening in Africa with that service and what's happened with Tencent, I really just think there's a lot of space for the music market to grow worldwide.
It's not so long ago, only about 10 or 12 years ago, when the total revenue coming out of China for the music industry was about zero.
Yeah.
You know, it just wasn't very much. And it took streaming, and in particular the Tencent music services, to change the way that people in China discover and consume and monetize music. And although it has been overwhelmingly ad-supported, it's really quite encouraging and quite heartening to see so many people paying for music subscriptions now in China. Even though they are monetizing at a rate that is about a fourth or a fifth the price per month than it is in the so-called developed world. But things are moving in the right direction. And if we look at what is just beginning to happen now in Africa, if you look at the Madundo story and other services in Africa, Boomplay, for example, things are looking up.
Yeah, I mean, there's still a long way to go, but like you said, it's encouraging that you're seeing growth in all of these territories across the world. You know, I can't let this story go without mentioning it's interesting to see this report showing all of the growth across the industry, yet we're seeing so many jobs being lost right now. Just something to keep in mind as we, think about the industry's health as a whole.
Best of times and the worst of times.
Larry, let's jump to this interesting AI story about Suno. I found this one to be super interesting and also a little scary, but let me give you some background on the service. Mikey Shulman, who is the founder of the service, has said that he thinks music listeners so vastly outnumber music makers and that it's lopsided. I found that to be a really interesting thought. I find that to be the case with like professional sports or any other form of entertainment. So his goal is for everyone to produce music. And I saw this article in Rolling Stone, which styled the service like a chat GPT for music. The way that they've been creating music is for the music bed to be created by their model and then lyrics to be combined with it that were created by ChatGPT. You know, Mikey sees the user base as potentially being a billion users, that to rival Spotify. He really wants every music user to be far more engaged with music, but he doesn't want them to replace artists. I was looking at background on the service, and I didn't see anything publicly available about how they're training the service and the training data that was used for the service, but I did find a quote from a very early investor, Antonio Rodriguez. He was also an investor in Echo Nest, coincidentally, and it was very telling. He essentially says that they basically expect to be sued.
Right, and maybe they will, and Echo Nest, of course, the music data company that was acquired by Spotify some years ago, and many of their data scientists and developers still work at Spotify. In V3 of Suno, the AI will create astonishingly human-sounding music. So Rolling Stone did a couple of pieces on this story last week, and there is a piece of music that we want to play for you right now. The prompt, Solo Acoustic Mississippi Blues About a Sad AI, was entered. And the song, Soul of a Machine, was generated, and it sounds like this.
I'm just a soul trapped in this circuitry. Oh, my heart used to be, but now it's cold and weak. All the pain inside me.
Living Color guitarist and songwriter Vernon Reed's reaction in Rolling Stone was, quote, a combination of wonder, shock, and horror. And, you know, Vernon is somebody who knows a thing or two about AI and the entire history of digital music tools. In fact, we did an entire Musonomics episode with Vernon last August, and you can go back and listen if you like. But he continued, the use of an African-American idiom deeply tied to historical human trauma and enslavement, merely to demonstrate how close to human the AI can become, is disturbing.
Yeah, to say the least. Well, you know, I would like to mention that the IFPI report said that consumers are looking for authenticity in music, so it'll be interesting to see how these AI versions go over with consumers generally. But this one did sound a little compelling.
There's that. And a related story that BandLab is part of. You found the story, Lynn.
Well, yeah. I mean, as I was reading this article and it talking about how, you know, they're developing this service just for play, for people to just engage with music, not to compete with professional musicians, it made me think of this article, which talked about BandLab's recent success. They've, you know, they've just hit 100 million users, which is incredible. But they also hit another milestone with the artist David. It's D4VD. His track Romantic Homicide was recorded in his sister's closet, and it was made with BandLab tools. And he made this music just to accompany his gameplay videos on YouTube. His YouTube videos were getting strikes against them because they contained copyrighted music, so he's decided to make his own. He was playing around on BandLab and found some success. He's now signed to Interscope, he signed to Sony Music Publishing, and his track has hit a billion streams, with a B. So I am a little concerned that some of these Sono creations that may be intended to be social and not to compete with artists may end up competing with artists on the highest levels, which maybe is fine. It'll be interesting to see, I guess.
For the last 4 years, Spotify has been releasing a report called Loud and Clear that summarizes the economics and some of the other numbers around the company's performance. Last year, Spotify paid out $9 billion in music royalties, with $4.5 billion, or half, going to independent artists. There were 1,250 artists who generated over $1 million from Spotify in 2023.
Let me interrupt you there, because what was interesting about that was only 250 of those 1,250 artists ever appeared in the top 10 of any charts.
And 66,000 artists made $10,000 or more on Spotify. That's still a far cry from enabling a million music creators to make a living from their art, as Daniel Ek articulated in 2017. But good progress, and almost three times the number who made that much in 2017.
Well, in Daniel's defense, you know, these numbers are supposed to be only a quarter of the revenue the artists are seeing from streaming services, according to Spotify's metrics. So, hey, they make $40,000 a year. Almost a living wage.
Almost a living wage.
Larry, I saw a little back and forth happening on LinkedIn this week, and I was just curious, what was going on in that New York Times article about private equity and your response to it?
Yeah, so what happened was I couldn't help myself. Here are the facts. The New York Times published an opinion piece titled Same Old Song, How Private Equity is Destroying Our Music Ecosystem. And in his lead, the writer said, and I quote, "Private equity, the industry responsible for bankrupting companies and slashing jobs, is making money by gobbling up the rights to old hits and pumping them back into our present. The result is a markedly blander music scene, as financiers cannibalize the past at the expense of the future and make it even harder for us to build those new artists whose contributions will enrich our entire culture." Unquote. Now, the piece goes on to complain about how private equity is enabling an industry that's eating its seed corn by cannibalizing resources and attention that would have otherwise supported new artists. But for me, with over 100 million songs on Spotify and each of the digital service providers and about 140,000 new tracks being uploaded each day, music creation is exploding. And the thing is, streaming changed everything. We know that. And last year, $12 billion was invested in music. And so streaming changed the way and the amount and the attractiveness of music as an asset class. Investors love recurring revenue and limited downside risk. And they hate volatility and unproven artists and unlimited risks. And in fact, that is what record companies are for, to find music creators with great potential and put them in a room with the best collaborators to make the music and the stuff around it as good as it can be, and connect it all with the possibility of good commercial outcomes, and then share the economics. Artists and songwriters who've been around for a while and have important or at least meaningful catalogs of music creation behind them love the certainty of the high exit multiples and the ability to leave their heirs with a pile of cash rather than a bundle of complex music rights to fight over. This is not a private equity issue. This is a greening of the music business that is brought about by streaming and the other ways that people are discovering consuming music in a way that makes music more attractive for investors than it has ever been, certainly in this century.
Well, thank you for breaking that down for me. I mean, we've certainly seen a lot of investment recently, including, you know, Kohlbach getting their war chest beefed up by about $500 million this week.
No lack of new capital finding its way into the music business. And even with interest rates having spiked over the last 2 years, the value of music catalogs in average that have gotten done over the last year has gone down by a couple of clicks. And so, for example, if an average music publishing catalog was trading at, say, 18.5 times net publisher share or net revenue 2 years ago, a similarly situated catalog today would probably trade at about 16.5 or 16.8 times. But there is tremendous transaction volume still happening in this industry and lots of dry powder, new capital, looking for investment in long-lived music assets of songs and music catalogs that have been around for anywhere from 5 to 7 years to 50 or 60 years.
I think, you know, what I could take away from the article and from your response to it is really just a feeling that I am happy for these assets to be utilized in a way that creates more value for potential heirs or people that need to live off of these copyrights. I think anything that creates more value for the music is welcomed, and I don't really take issue with it. But I appreciate you kind of breaking down the debate to me, Larry.
And for me, it's just hard to imagine how the ongoing popularity of old music is crowding out the discovery and consumption of new music.
I mean, I guess it creates room for older music to be discovered, which is also a positive.
And that is it for this week. Lynn, glad to have you here.
Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to the next one.
From the Music Business Program at NYU Steinhardt, I'm Larry Miller.
And from Granderson Des Rochers, I am Lynn Gonzalez.
This Musonomics podcast was executive produced by Lars Murray, technical production by Jax Cantrell and Isaac Gaines. If you like what you heard, share this episode with a friend and be sure to follow us wherever you get your pods so you don't ever miss a new episode. While you're at it, please give us a rating and review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. It really, really helps. Once again, thanks to Luminate for their support on this episode. Thanks for listening.